My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just one of thousands of men and women who are grateful to be clean and sober today. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. The lobby last night was worth the whole trip. I mean, I just absolutely loved that. I mean, with the fight crowd, you know, drinking and drugging, and, you know, the guys in the full-length mink coats and the hookers, and then there's us, and then there's the sweet Adelines coming through, you know. Large hordes of middle-aged ladies in matching outfits, you know, and it was what it used to be like, what happened, and what I was afraid it was going to be like now, you know. I mean, the drunks were the straightest-looking group in the lobby. I loved it, you know. We've come a long way, haven't we? I was born in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, and I'm the firstborn son of a drunken sailor and an Irish saint. And that's what everybody told my mother. You're a saint, Pat, to put up with that. And so I grew up in an alcoholic household, and nobody escapes an alcoholic household. I started making the adjustments that the kid of a drunk does. I had an interfered with relationship with a parent of the same sex, and so I never learned how to be intimate. I never had anybody that I could talk to, that I could share my innermost fears and dreams with, because he was frequently absent. And so I never learned how to be intimate with anybody. I never learned how to be able to be vulnerable and tell you who I was. Because I got rejected a couple of times when I was a kid, and I didn't try it anymore, and I became a floater. I became the kind of person who couldn't attach to anybody or anything. Also, I was hypersensitive. I've always been hypersensitive. You can hurt my feelings by not saying hello to me. You know, it's important to me that the mailman likes me, the bus drivers like me. I have, you know, elevator operators were a real big thing with me. And maids in hotels that you don't even see, I want them to like me. I used to make my own bed so that they think I was neat, you know. And that's pretty, you know, some tests on us, some medical evidence on us has come out with the fact that as a group, alcoholics tend to perceive colors more brightly, hear sounds more loudly, and feel pain more acutely than the rest of the population, and that's certainly true in my case. And with that combination as a child, that produced some anxiety in me, and I took a hard and fast look at myself when I was 8 or 9 years old, and I made some conclusions about myself based on the way I gathered evidence. And the way I gathered evidence was I compared my insides with your outsides, and I could tell that you were all doing just fine, but that I had been damaged in the shipping, obviously. And I decided that because I wasn't perfect, I wasn't worth anything. And so I threw myself away. I was 8 or 9 years old. And then I spent the rest of my life compensating for that decision. I also decided that because I had this intense group of emotions that I knew were capable of sweeping me away, and that I had to control them. I mean, they talk about alcoholics not having any self-control. We are the most controlled human beings in the world. I mean, I have been controlling my emotions since I was a child. Because I knew that if I got too happy, I'd get hysterical, and if I got too sad, I'd kill myself. I've always known that, and so I've always been careful, you know? And I decided that I had all that stuff going on inside of me, and that made me crazy. And that was my first secret, was that I was crazy. Now, I was crazy, but I wasn't stupid. I knew that if you acted crazy, they took you someplace, and they never brought you back. So I started compensating for the fact that I was crazy. I learned how to, I learned social skills. I learned how to say please and thank you. I learned what fork to use. I learned how to achieve in school. I learned how to dress appropriately for any occasion. I learned how to be a nice guy so that you wouldn't know that I was nuts. And that was what was going on with me. When I was about 11 or 12 years old, I realized what the problem was in our household. I realized that my father drank too much, and I started observing him. And one of the things that I noticed was that when he was upset and he had a drink, he calmed down. And I stashed that information away. And when I was 14 years old, I found comfort. Southern comfort was what I found. And I absolutely loved it. I mean, the reason I'm standing here tonight, or today, or whatever the hell time it is morning, yes, my God. The reason I'm standing here is that I love to drink. Make no mistake about that. I loved everything about it. You know, the first time I took that big belt of Southern Comfort, it was like taking a bite out of a thunderstorm. You know, the lightning crackled all the way down, and there was this deep roll of thunder at the bottom, you know. And I understood at a very deep gut level why my father was willing to go to jail. I had been living all my life under the crushing burden of potential, you know. People had always said, you're so bright if you just apply yourself, you know? And after I had that belt of Southern comfort, I met my potential. I was everything I needed to be. I was bright, I was charming, I was handsome, I could dance with you, I could talk to you, I could do God knows what with you, and proceeded to. The first night I got drunk, I blacked out and I threw up, and I decided that the way to be a successful drinker was not to throw up. I was a blackout drinker from the beginning of my drinking until the end, and I never even bothered to ask anybody about that. I thought everybody who drank didn't remember parts of it. It didn't even bother me. I got real grateful for blackouts later. I don't know about you, you know. Whew. When I was 17 years old, my mother became worried that I was working too hard during exam time, and she gave me one of her diet pills. God bless that woman. And I became an instant speed freak, just bam, you know. One of the things that I had noticed was that I wasn't a very good drinker. I used to get very drunk on very little, but when I dropped speed, I could drink a whole lot and I'd be up all night, you know. I first started getting loaded in the 60s, and we're the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We snatched it out of the hands of black musicians and brought it into the family rooms of America. We're the generation that discovered that you could open up the Secadol tablets and, you know, lick all the stuff off your hand and then crumple up aspirin and put them back in the capsules and put them back in your parents' medicine cabinets, you know. We're the first ones who did that. And so from then on, I started doing it. When I was 18 years old, I said the first phrase that defines an alcoholic. I declared myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know I had done it. Only an alcoholic ever says this phrase. Nobody else ever says it. A social drinker never says it. If you've ever seen anybody who has said it, or if you've ever said it yourself, you're looking at a drunk. And that phrase is, I can control my drinking. I was 18 years old when I said it, because by that time, I was in trouble with the chemicals. But the prospect of living without them was even more terrifying. That's the definition of addiction. And so what I started doing was I started cooking. I started recipes, trying to figure out which chemicals would go with which to produce a feeling of non-feeling. See, that's all I've ever wanted out of life is out. You know? I just didn't want to feel anything. I just didn't want to be embarrassed. I have spent my life being embarrassed. You know? And when I was loaded, I wasn't embarrassed. I was embarrassed the next morning, but I was never embarrassed while I was loaded. And I just didn't feel anything. I just wanted to desensitize. I needed to. And so it went on. When I was 18 or 19 years old, I decided that the insides were never going to get any better. See, one of the things that I had decided as a child was, see, I had been born without the ability to love. Some people are born with it. I mean, some people just run around going, love, 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 not me. There was something very cold in the center of me that couldn't get warmed up. And what I decided would fix that problem was to get a lot of people to love me. It never occurred to me to learn how to love anybody. I thought it happened to you accidentally. I'd seen far too many movies, you know. And if I couldn't get people to love me, I've always been willing to settle for attention. Some of the things that I've done for attention appall me today, but one of the things that I knew was that if you asked somebody a question, they'd find out you were in trouble and they'd throw you away. And I wasn't willing to risk that. So I had stopped asking questions as a child. And so it was getting worse and worse for me internally. And by the time I was 18 or 19 years old, I realized that since I wasn't going to ask any questions, I wasn't going to get any help. So the insides were not going to get any better, and I better work on the outside. Now, there wasn't much hope. I was tall and I was fat. You know, short and fat's adorable, and tall and thin is what everybody wants to be. Tall and fat is the pit, you know. I looked like a giant avocado, you know. It all went to my ass. I mean, it never went to my shoulders. It all went, you know. And I was weird, you know. I was a weird kid. But when you're chewing amphetamines, you drop a lot of tonnage. You know, who wants to shut up long enough to eat lunch? And I got a job, and I got myself a pair of contact lenses, and I got my teeth capped, and shazam, I was gorgeous. And all of a sudden, a lot of people started noticing me, and I liked that very much. They also noticed that after I had a couple of drinks, I was capable of doing just about anything. And so consequently, I stand before you today with no fantasy unlived. I have done everything that has ever occurred to me to do. I am deeply grateful there's some things I never thought of. But there aren't many. We were getting into costumes toward the end there. I came to this fellowship the way we all come. I've been too many places and seen too much and heard too much and done too much and learned far too little. I was hip and I was sophisticated and I was cool and I was dangerously naive about the basics of life. And so I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, and I went to New York. I was 21 years old, and within 2 months I had my first Broadway show, and that should have fixed me. That's beyond anything I ever dreamed of. By the time I was 24, I had done several Broadway shows. I was standing on the stage of the Winter Garden Theater nightly, alone on the stage with a 45-piece orchestra and a spotlight on my face. And I sang a song every night in a sold-out house, applauded, and that should have fixed me, and I got loaded every night. And I was going to all the right parties and stupid all the right people, and I was doing all the right stuff. I was crazy and wild and good-looking and living in New York and having a hell of a good time. And I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I'd picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit, and I had three doctors that I went to in Manhattan with similar complaints. I had developed sincerity as a weapon, and I would go and sincerely talk to them about stress, and they would give me downers, or I would sincerely talk to them about the fact that I was a working model and had to watch my weight, and so they'd give me uppers. And then we would all meet and drink and exchange our pills. We never took our own, you know. We always kind of swapped, you know. I was the kind of drunk that if you invited me to your house for dinner at some time during the evening, I would excuse myself and go to your medicine cabinet and you know, go through it and take whatever was pretty, you know. 20 minutes later, you'd either have to, you know, peel me off the bathroom ceiling or you'd find me sprawled on the bathroom floor, depending on what I'd found in your medicine cabinet. And see, I knew that I was living the great alcoholic lie. I was living the lie of alcoholism, and that lie is, you've still got time. You can do this for another week, Sean, and then straighten up for a week, and you'll be all right. I was 24, and I knew about alcoholism. I knew it killed old dudes with cirrhosis of the liver. What I didn't want to look at is how it killed us young, cute, adorable ones. Those of us with big blue eyes and straight teeth who were appearing on Broadway and doing glamorous things. Those of us who were living lives that other people envied. Those of us who were chewing vitamins and watching our weight and exercising regularly. Those of us who were wonderful, in wonderful shape and had a world of promise ahead of us. What I didn't want to look at was the fact that my best friend in high school hanged himself as a freshman in college because he couldn't kick a drug habit, and that's alcoholism. I didn't want to look at the fact that one of my best friends in New York, who was one of the cutest chorus boys on Broadway, I was one of the other ones sitting out there. He was a diabetic, and he drank like I did. And when he was 28 years old, he was blind, and he was senile, and he didn't want to live anymore, so he pulled the plug on his kidney machine. That's how he died, and that's alcoholism. Another friend of mine used to do suicide attempts. You remember suicide attempts? You know, when you take the pills and you make the phone call knowing they'll show up in time? You know? Or you open the car door on the freeway and you lean out real slow so somebody will grab you before your face actually hits the pavement? Terry used to do that. We used to call each other and say, oh, Terry's killed himself, and we'd all go running over there and we'd walk him around Central Park, you know. It was a game. And one night he got very drunk and took too many pills and he made a phone call. And the paramedics showed up in time, but they gave him just a tidge too much oxygen, and he's been a vegetable in a VA hospital for 19 years. That's alcoholism. This is a deadly disease, and it kills us young, cute, adorable ones real dead, real fast, and we don't even know it's alcoholism that did it. We do it with cigarettes and sofas, or we forget to turn off the gas, or we forget just how many Seconal we took with how much scotch. Or we fall out of windows, or we trip in front of buses, or we hit bridge pilings at 80 miles an hour, or we make decisions while we're loaded that we can't get out of, and they find us beaten to death in alleys. It's a deadly disease, make no mistake about this. This weekend is not a dry cocktail party. We're here to save our lives, and I have to remember that. I have to remember that. But I didn't know anything about that. I knew I was having life problems. And I mean, I was having life problems. I mean, I was doing things like, well, I see, I was a blackout drinker, and so I got into that. See, I don't have a great drunkalogue. I never, you know, stole the tugboat or came to in Paris or any of that good stuff, you know? I just did a series of sleazy, embarrassing, shabby, tacky, crummy things over and over and over again, interspersed with promises that tomorrow it's going to be different, and then there were occasional spectacular achievements, you know? And if you looked at my life, you'd probably believe that those spectacular achievements were designed to convince you that I was better than you. And that was never, ever, ever true. I always thought if I did something extraordinary, you'd think that I was equal to you. And I kept getting into trouble, you know. I kept making the promises that it ain't going to happen tonight, you know. And then you come to at 11 o'clock in the morning and you're laying next to it. And you don't know who it is. Or what it is. Or what you've done with it. Or what you promised it. And you don't know whether you're at its place or your place. And you know where your clothes are. And you got to get out of there without waking it up, you know? I mean, that's monumental, you know? And if you keep doing those kind of things, one day you come to and you're laying next to it and it's awake. And it's looking at you. And you look in its eyes and you realize that you've become its it. And you know that's funny. But they all had to be it. They all had to be a trick or a number or a squeeze. They couldn't be human. They couldn't be human beings with feelings and needs. They couldn't be as desperate as I was. They couldn't be willing to throw away everything they believed in for a moment's intimacy like I was. Because if they were human, and if I looked at them as human, needing, hurting people, the despair would crash in. And that happened occasionally. But I was getting skilled at teaching myself not to feel anything. You got to do that as a practicing drunk. You got to teach yourself not to be angry, humiliated, or embarrassed, because you always are, you know? The only trouble is you can't teach half your emotions to go dead. If you manage not to be angry, embarrassed, or humiliated, you also can't love, trust, or care about anybody. It was true in my case. And what was happening as I was going emotionally dead, the essence of me, the soul, the thing that makes me different from an animal, was getting frightened that the organism it was living in was going dead and it would start making demands on me. And I believe this is where the alcoholic insanity would come from, you know? Occasionally, I'd just have to do something crazy just to get that adrenaline rush, you know, that tight feeling right at the pit of your stomach above your crotch, you know, where you can taste the danger in the sides of your mouth, you know, that adrenaline rush, just to know that I was actually alive, you know? And so I used to do things like get drunk on the east side of Manhattan and walk across Central Park at 3 o'clock in the morning in a suit. You don't do that and survive. I did it all the time, you know? I used to come out of blackouts in the middle of Harlem, you know? Not a bright thing to do for a blonde kid in the 60s, you know? I remember one time I came out of a blackout and I came out of a blackout and I was in the middle of Harlem and this voice from an alley said, "That son of a bitch looks like Kim Novak." And I thought, I'm going to die here. Or I'm going to hope I'm going to die here. And there were waterfront bars that I thought were just swell. You know, the kind where people get killed. I love those kind of places. I would go down in my preppy outfit, you know, and I would find the two guys that looked like they hated each other the most, and I would tell one of them that the other one said something about him and watch them kill each other. I mean, that was my kind of fun. This is a disease of inches and seconds, and there are friends of mine who are inches away and seconds behind me who aren't here anymore. The fact that I survived is a miracle. But by the time I was 24, I was in desperate trouble, and I started making moves to solve my problems. One of the things that I decided, I went to a shrink and entertained him for 8 months. God bless him. He helped me. He got me down to a fifth of scotch a day, and he gave me a prescription for Valium and another one for Seconal. God bless him. I don't put down the psychiatric profession. They're just incapable of helping practicing alcoholics because we're incapable of telling the truth, you know? I managed to talk to him for 8 months, and we talked about my parents and stress, but we never talked about the fact that I was consuming large amounts of alcohol. Most competent psychiatrists won't touch an alcoholic until he's got a year of sobriety. They're catching on to it. Because they know that we're nuts before we get here, and then the first year we're here, we're even worse. Yeah. I looked into Eastern religions as an intellectual pursuit. I didn't want you to know that I was in trouble spiritually. See, I'd been raised an Irish Catholic, and by the time I was 24, I had broken every one of the Ten Commandments, and that's a biggie for an Irish Catholic kid. I tried not to notice it, but since I couldn't practice my religion, I didn't have a God. I had God and religion all mixed up. So I believe that's when my disease took a nosedive because I became spiritually lost. So what I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. We were both going to do a show together, and she was a little dancer, and she had blonde hair and dimples, and she looked cute as hell in her little leotard. I noticed her right off the bat. She didn't notice me until about 3 days later when my back went out, and I crawled into rehearsal, and zing went the strings of her heart. I didn't know that for an Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. She realized at a very deep level that I needed her. And one of the things as we became friends, we noticed that our assets and our defects kind of meshed, you know. you know, what she was lacking, I had, and vice versa. And so what we did was we were like two crippled children who became one decent adult. You know, that's what we tried to do. And we began our dance of death. And we eventually tangoed into AA and Al-Anon, but we went around the floor a while. And we had it all. We had it all. Our friends called us the Campbell Soup Kids. They said we were the cutest kids in the block. We had this great little apartment on the west side of Manhattan. We were in the theater. We had glamorous friends. We were doing exciting things. And there was something terribly wrong. She became a French chef, a cordon bleu chef, and I decided that hard booze was the problem, so I became a wine connoisseur. That's a wino with a checkbook. I have guzzled some of the finest French wines ever made, you know. Hostesses would look in horror as I downed $35 bottles of Chateau Lafite, you know. My, what an excellent year. Yeah. I've been sober a while, and I have never sipped anything in my entire life, you know. Ever, you know. And I'm an old pillhead, you know. It's really funny. My wife is an Al-Anon, you know. Those Al-Anon. And when she's got a cold, she has to take an aspirin. So what she does, she gets this great big thing of water, and then she takes this aspirin. She goes, you know. I get up in the morning. I take my vitamins. You know, I go, get this aspirin. I go, yeah. That's why I take them. Open the throat, and down it goes. Yeah. I was experimenting in a lot of drugs at this time. I was very careful, though. For instance, I never shot heroin. The reason I never shot heroin was I felt that I was probably addictive. And I knew that if I ever did that within a week, I'd be living in some sleazy hotel and stealing my friend's portable television sets. And I needed people too badly. And the other thing was I never dropped acid. The reason I never dropped acid was that I had always known that I was crazy. And I knew that if I ever chemically induced that state, I'd never get back. And so those are my two things. But then I indulged in drug of choice. That's my favorite phrase, drug of choice. My drug of choice was based on availability. I don't know about yours. Yeah. Whatever was around, I didn't give a shit. You know, whatever got you off, that was what I was interested in. We moved to California. We did an Actors Geographic. It's called the National Tour. And California was going to be a new beginning. I don't know about you, but I'm up to my ass in new beginnings. You know, I just a lot of those things going on. But California was going to be it. And then I decided that being an Irish peasant, if I owned a piece of the land, that would do it. And so we bought a house in the Hollywood Hills. And then they judge you by your car in California, so I bought a Mercedes. We owned a Mercedes, but some nights we didn't eat. You know, that's just the way it is. And then I got a spiffy wardrobe, and then I got into another career and added a career and... And that's the way it was, and I drank and used drugs every day of my life. And then I found myself in the saddest state that a practicing alcoholic can be in. See, alcoholics never marry teetotalers. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink, and the girl that I married drank like I did. She was terrific. We drank together, and it was dynamite, you know? And then we came to California, and we got married, and she settled down. And then she stopped drinking. She just, I'll never forget it. One day we were in our living room, she had a vodka Gibson in her hand, and she took a couple of sips and she said, "This is boring," and she put it down. She never drank again. She had no withdrawals, nothing. She wasn't a drunk, you know. She didn't have the disease. And then she noticed that I drank. But by this time, see, I don't know about you, but I needed to drink. It had ceased to be a luxury for me. It was an absolute necessity. It was medicinal. I was medicating myself with it, you know. I knew that if I did not drink or use drugs on a daily basis, I would go insane. I knew that. And I wasn't willing to do that. I knew I was never going to climb a tower and blow away 35 people or any of that stuff, you know. I knew what would happen to me was that they would find me sitting on a park bench somewhere smiling into the sun, and they would take me to Sunnybrook Farms, and they'd never bring me back. And I wasn't willing to do that. And so I needed to protect my right to drink. And if love could cure alcoholism, I wouldn't need to be here, because I have been well-loved for many, many years. I've always loved that woman, and she's always loved me, and we've always wanted each other to be the best possible human beings we could be. But I needed to drink. So I started giving her helpful hints. I started saying things like, "Oh, you're going to wear that dress. You know, I've always liked your hair up. I don't think you should have said that at dinner, darling. I think you upset the host." Helpful hints so that she could become a better human being. And the clear-cut message in it was that if she was taller, if she was shorter, if she was brighter, if she wasn't so bright, if she worked, if she stayed home, if she cooked, if she gardened, if she painted, if she was a redhead, if she was a brunette, if she was somehow different, I wouldn't have to drink. And the sad thing about people who love alcoholics is she bought that. And I never wanted her to. I always thought one day she'd say, "Hold it, Sean, it's not my fault. You drink, not me." But she never did. She had her own set of problems. Whenever we had a fight, I won. If it took 3 weeks, I won. And I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife who worked. And I would show up to the job, you know, the bills were being paid. And so whenever she crowded me about my drinking, I'd say, "But darling, the bills are paid, back off." And she did. And I didn't want it to be like that. About 6 months before we got to the program, we had a vicious fight. I've never been a physically violent alcoholic. I'm a psychologically violent alcoholic. If you hurt my feelings, I'll find an interesting way for you to lose your job. I have a shark-infested mouth, and I have done incredible damage with it. And we had a vicious fight, and I never laid a glove on her, but it was pretty awful. See, I was a blackout drinker, and I had become skilled at asking questions in the morning, so you didn't know you were being questioned, so I could find out what went on the night before, and I blew it that day. And she realized she had been living with somebody for 5 years who was a blackout drinker, and she had not ever known that. And she got very, very frightened. And then being a good Al-Anon, pre-Al-Anon, she denied it. But I started praying for the first time in a long time, and it was very different from, you know, I told you I'd tossed out the religion at 24. I had learned those two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, "Dear God, get me out of this, and I will never do it again." And the second alcoholic prayer is, "Whew." But I started praying for the first time in a long time, and the prayer was, "Dear God, let this stop." Because I was living with the kind of terror that we accept as alcoholics, you know, the kind of diminished life. I had always surrounded myself with people who drank and used drugs worse than I did, and they were getting harder and harder to find, you know. And there were fewer and fewer people, and the people who knew that I was a drunk shied away, and the people who didn't know that I was a drunk thought I was crazy. And so I was becoming socially inconvenient, you know. I was becoming a bother at dinner parties and obnoxious at parties, and you know, so we were just not being invited anywhere. And one of the things that I assimilated into my life as an alcoholic, which is kind of typical of the terror we accept and live with on a daily basis. I didn't realize until I was about 5 years sober, I was standing outside my house in the pouring rain in my bathrobe looking for the paper one morning, and I said, "What am I doing here? I don't care about the LA Times." And bam, it hit me what I was doing there. It was something I had done from the time I'd moved to California, because blackout drinking had brought a new terror to me. And what I did was, no matter how hungover I was, no matter how sick I was, I got up, I put on my bathrobe, I went out to the front of the house, I picked up the newspaper, and I walked back up the driveway and made one quick turn around the car to see if there were any blood stains or dents. And I did that every morning of my life, along with shaving and showering and getting dressed to go to work. And that horrifies me today. And it was just something I accepted. We have to accept that, because if we ever stop and look at it, our life disintegrates. So anyway, I started praying. On an April 23rd, 1974, God answered my prayers. I was arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squadron, a particularly sleazy little charge. It was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance. The front of my pants from the waistband to the knees was soaked in my own urine. And I went home and poured what I hope to God was the last drink. It was straight vodka in a wine glass. And for the first time in my life, I put together my behavior with drinking and using drugs. And until that second, I was dying from a hopeless disease that I did not have. This is a self-diagnosed disease. Several people had suggested that I drank too much. A couple had even said I was alcoholic. And I don't care how many earnest people intervene, until the alcoholic himself diagnoses the problem, you're looking at somebody who's dying of a disease that he doesn't know he has. And it is horrifying. But I put it together and I said, "I wonder if I'm an alcoholic." That's the incredible thing about us drunks, is our unbelievable ability to overlook overwhelming evidence, you know. And then I said, "I hope to God I am a drunk, because if I am not, I am hopelessly insane. There is no hope for me, because I had done everything that I could think to do to avoid coming to that decision, you know. I wanted to be anything but an alcoholic, anything but an alcoholic." On April 24th, 1974, I took aside somebody I'd been working with for a year. I liked the way she acted. She was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was having a hell of a good time. And I took her aside at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I have 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And I thank God for the people who've got time on the program, because she heard the screaming, you know." I'd been living all my life with a ball of screaming in my chest, you know. On the good days, it sat right down there in the middle of the chest. On the bad days, it slips up behind your vocal cords. And those are the days that if you have a flat tire or break a shoelace, it'll slip past your vocal cords, and you'll scream, and you'll scream, and you'll scream, and you'll scream, and they'll take you someplace, and they won't bring you back. And she heard that screaming, and she told me her story. She read to me from the big book, and she took me to my first meeting. My first meeting was exactly as I feared it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It had gray walls and a low ceiling. It was filled with smoke, and all those people that I never would have drank with were there. And I said for years that I loved it. I said for years that I loved it. And that wasn't true. I've always mistaken my emotions. The one thing that happened, though, at that meeting that I came to recognize as the truth was I felt safe. I felt safe in that room that first night. And it, no matter what's gone on since then in my life, whenever I get, what kind of day I've got, whenever I get to an alcoholics meeting, an honest meeting, and sit down, I'm safe for an hour and a half. And if any of you thinking you're getting your act together and drifting on out of this fellowship, if you think that's what this fellowship is about, if you're here to get your act together, let me tell you how I arrived. I drove to my first meeting in my Mercedes. I had on a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. I had on French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I had several national commercials running on television. I had always been cast as the nice young man next door. I'd been paid $300 for a day's work as a model about 4 or 5 days before I got to the program. I looked wonderful. I had a house in the hills, a pedigree dog, a pretty wife, a spiffy wardrobe, and all that kind of stuff. And I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I walked into that room, and everybody knew that I was a drunk. There were a couple of things that were going on that night that I wasn't aware of. One of them was that I had been drinking straight vodka the night before, and it was a warm night, and I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet. And the other thing that was going on was that I had newcomer eyes. The only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I was absolutely terrified. I didn't know what you were going to do to me, or what you were going to make me do, or what you're going to make me wear. I had a feeling that we were all going to wear uniforms. You know, I thought, not really, you know, I thought we were all going to wear navy blue work pants and navy blue work shirts, you know, buttoned. And then we'd all sit around in groups and talk about the medical and psychological ramifications of alcoholism. And then we'd break up into small groups of 4 or 5 and we'd go to bars and give people literature, you know. I had this kind of idea of kind of a dry watchtower group, you know. It didn't appeal to me at all, you know. The one thing that absolutely threw me that first night, that absolutely threw me, was the laughter. The laughter, I believe, saved my life. Because I didn't think there was anything funny about the prospect of living the rest of my life without something to take the edge off. Now, I had hoped to descend into sobriety on a pink cloud of Valium. I kind of wanted to drift into this thing. I mean, no use getting crazy about this. You know, and I mean, it was all tied up with, you know, drugs and alcohol, you know, but see, I got sober in Hollywood, and they were on to me, and it was explained to me that sobriety, they defined as clean and sober, and I was disappointed. See, I told you we're the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We're the generation that changed and expanded the definition of alcoholism, and when we started crawling into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we changed and expanded the definition of sobriety. So if there's anybody here who's not drinking, but you're smoking a little grass, or you're doing the odd line of coke, you're taking a little Seconal, a little Desbutol, a little Odalep, a little Quaalude, a little NyQuil, a little turbine hydrate of codeine, a little amyl nitrate, keep coming back. We just love visitors. But do not for a second think that you are sober because you are not. And I want to make that real clear, because I have buried some very nice people in the last 10 and a half years who have said things like, there's nothing about marijuana in the big book, and that's very true. There's also nothing about nuclear submarines or microwave ovens in the big book either. The people who wrote the big book had the humility to say that this book is meant to be suggestive only. And throughout the years, we have certainly found out a great deal more about the disease of alcoholism than was known in 1935. However, we have found out nothing new about the recovery process from alcoholism since 1935. There are certain medical exceptions to that. I mean, I am not proposing open-heart surgery whilst biting on a bullet. I mean, that's nuts. I mean, there are certain medical procedures that require drugs. And there are some people who have to use psychotropics in order to be sane enough to work this program. But there are far fewer of those than the medical profession would like us to think. I have a wonderful beef about the medical profession. In a godless society, we have raised the stature of doctors to demigods. And I think it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous for alcoholics. Very dangerous for alcoholics, because I believe that most people who have been sober around 5 years in this fellowship, who have been working the program, working the steps, doing 12-step works, and who are active within this fellowship, understand more about the causes and conditions and recovery from alcoholism than 95% of the medical profession. For the most part, the medical profession's knowledge of alcoholism is based on 4 to 6 hours of classroom time as a student, and then as interns, they work in emergency wards and see skid row bums brought in, and they believe that that is alcoholism. And then they believe us when we go to their offices as practicing MDs and talk about stress. The reason they don't know anything about alcoholism is we lie to them. And what's happening is they're finally wising up. In Bakersfield, for instance, I just found out recently, student nurses and doctors are required to read the big book, study it, and go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. UCLA has set up a program where student doctors are required to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. We are educating them, you know. And I believe it is time for us to reverse our posture in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, one of the reasons that we've been kind of subservient to the medical profession is one of our founders was a disgraced doctor, you know, and I think he was trying a little hard to get back in their good graces, you know. These days we're paying $12,000 for a 30-day chip. And that's too bad. It's too bad because they're missing. They're missing an extraordinary time in sobriety. An extraordinary time. When I got sober, you either got sober in the rooms or you went to something called a recovery house. We didn't have spiffy hospitals where you went, you know? We don't even give the newcomers half a cup of coffee anymore. I mean, they're so steady they can drink a full cup. But it was incredible, those first days of shaking it out in those rooms, because you understood at a real deep level that these people were there for you. You know, that they would go the mile for you. They would stay up all night with you if you needed it, and it was an incredible time. I met my sponsor the first night that I was sober. He came up to me and he shook my hand and he said, I'm not a psychiatrist, but if you call me tonight, and you tell me how you feel, and I tell you how I feel, probably neither of us will have to get loaded. And so I started calling him. And he started me in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? There's a lot of people who are coming into this fellowship who are what is known as dually addicted. And it's causing some problems within this fellowship in various parts of the country. There are some old-timers who have had no... you know, experience with drugs, and it frightens them, and that's fine, you know, but 85% of the people, I believe, who are coming to the fellowship these days are dually addicted, you know. It's all part of it. It's intrinsically part of it, and so it is important that we understand that sobriety is clean and sober. I certainly qualify as an alcoholic addict, but I identify as an alcoholic because that's the name of the disease. I believe that drug addiction and alcoholism are two aspects of the same disease, and the disease is named alcoholism. If it had been identified by the AMA in the 70s or the 80s, it might have been called chemical dependency or sedativism or some other spiffy medical name. But it was identified in the early part of the century when the drug of choice of the civilized world was alcohol, so it got called alcoholism. That's the name of the disease. And so that's how I identify, because I want to understand who everyone is. You know, there's some fear in Alcoholics Anonymous that there are great hordes of non-alcoholic addicts who are trying to take over the fellowship, and I think that I just want to assure you that nobody aspires to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Nobody shoots for it, you know? And I think it's really important for us to understand that anybody who comes to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and identifies himself as an addict is simply indulging in the most contemporary form of denial. You know, and if we are tolerant and if we are loving, you see a wonderful process happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see those guys get up at podiums and identify as addicts, and that's swell. bore us to death with your chemicals, convince us you're more badass than we are. That's wonderful. But stick around and listen to the causes and conditions, and listen to the feelings. And what happens to those guys is they get up at podiums then after a little while and identify as addict alcoholics. And then they get a sponsor and they work the 12 steps and they keep getting more involved in the fellowship and they get up at podiums and identify as alcoholic addicts. And then they get involved in general service or central service and they keep going on with this thing and they get up and identify as alcoholics. Because eventually what happens is if you stay here long enough, you understand that the name of this fellowship has two words in it, alcoholic and anonymous. And see, I thought that anonymity meant that we were a secret society so that nobody would know that we were drunks. And that's not what it is. That's not what it is. Anonymity is a spiritual concept. Anonymity is real humility at work. The 12 and 12 talks about this. And what it is me giving up my need to distinguish myself, either within this fellowship or out there. I give up my need to be different. And what I have come to find out is the thing that will save my life is finding what is the same about us, not what is different, you know? And I have had to give up my celebrating my difference. And I think special interest groups in Alcoholics Anonymous are important. I think we should have gay meetings and doctor meetings and lawyer meetings and Indian chief meetings. I think it's terrific, you know? I myself like to hang out with my own socioeconomic group, the creme de la scum, you know? You know, all us yuppies, you know, or middle management positions with young families who all go, you know, shopping for Volvo station wagons together. I mean, that's important that I hang out with those guys to understand that we're all staying sober. That is important for identification, but for recovery, it is critical that I understand that I am exactly the same as everyone in every one of these rooms, you know. And the wonderful thing that has happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is as I have been willing to give up what makes me different, the things that are really unique about me, the special gifts that God has given me, have just kind of floated to the surface, you know? And they're different gifts than I thought I had, you know? Just by being willing to be the same as you. I surrendered the first day of sobriety. I mean, I have a talent for surrender. It's no big deal. I've surrendered my life to people with stronger opinions and louder voices than me all my life, you know? And so surrender was, I was no pearl of great price when I arrived, and so it wasn't very hard. And surrender has three parts to it, and if I don't have all three parts, I can't surrender. Two out of three don't count, and the three parts of surrender are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Ta-da! I mean, my entire sobriety has been a series of stumbling over the obvious. You know, it's all this stuff that you've known about for years. But the honesty for me is out loud honesty. I have to be willing to tell you out loud what the problem is. And then the open-mindedness is I have to be willing to listen to your sober experience. I can discount your psychological theories and your religious dogma, but I must listen to your sober experience. And then the willingness is that I have to be willing to do exactly what you tell me to do. And in my life and times in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come to you and told you out loud what the problem was. Listen to your sober experience. You've told me what to do, and I said, my God, that's it? That's so simple. Those few things. God bless you. You've changed my life. Keep coming back. And then I go out and do exactly what I wanted to do in the first place. And what that's saying is thank you and screw you. And that's anger. That's anger. It's not the kind of anger that's attractive to talk about from podiums. I mean, the fun anger to talk about from podiums is, and then I shoved his teeth down his throat. I mean, that's great stuff, you know. But what I've been forced to do in order to recover somewhat is talk about the other kind of anger, the gossip, the taking the inventory, the wasting people's time, the being pissed off, you know, the nasty little grungy stuff that is real unattractive. And in the process of doing that, I have come to find out that anger is not a real emotion. Anger is an attitude that I developed to cover a real emotion. It is a learned response. And the real emotion is always fear. I hate being afraid. I don't know anybody who's crazy about it. You know, I just hate it. And when I was a child, in order not to feel afraid, I learned to get angry. And as I got older, I learned to make the response time shorter and shorter and shorter, so that what happened was that if it looked like you were going to frighten me, I got angry first. You know, so I didn't even feel fear. And so that's what happened to me. I was this angry human being, and I didn't even know what was going on. And one of the extraordinary gifts you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous is the moment to dismantle that emotion. When I'm angry, to have the moment to say, hold it. What am I afraid of? And I'm always afraid of one or two things. Big Book talks about it. I'm either afraid of not getting something I want, or I'm going to lose something I got. Never any different than that. Never any different than that. I hated being that simple. I just hated being that simple. The first three steps are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. The honesty part of the first step is my life, you know, that I was powerless over alcohol and drugs and my life was unmanageable. I mean, my life was dribbling down my sleeve at that point. I mean, it's real easy to take that step the first day you're sober. You know, it's harder after you got a couple of years of sobriety and things are getting together, you know. But one of the things that I have found out is that if I try to shape my life, I will shatter it. I have tried it a couple of times in sobriety and I've done it, you know. And so I have given up my right to manage my life. That doesn't mean I don't make plans. That doesn't mean I don't set goals. I do the footwork and God lays the results in my lap. And they're usually interesting. The open-mindedness part of the second step is just that I am open-minded enough to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. Could restore me to sanity. They don't even demand that I accept that he would, you know, and then my arrogance told me that the only power greater than me is God. There's me and then God. I'd like to thank you for your help, but I'm talking to God today, you know. And what I've come to find out in Alcoholics Anonymous is that somebody with 20 minutes more sobriety than me is a power greater than me. That the big book is a power greater than me. The room like this is a power greater than me. And they're all, my sponsor is power greater than me. And they're all things that are designed to lead me to the power that I need to find out about. And could restore me to sanity. See, I was an upper middle class drunk, and we didn't go to funny farms. I mean, really. We went to therapists and talked about stress. So I had a little trouble with the second step. I mean, I thought insanity was rubber rooms and paper slippers and no doorknobs on this side, you know. And that hadn't been my experience. And about a couple of weeks after I got sober, I was taking a friend of mine to a meeting and had a big old-fashioned medical dictionary on his desk. And I looked up a definition of insanity. And it had this great big huge definition. And out of the middle of it popped a phrase. Medical definition of insanity. Quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Close quote. Sociopathy. Repeating the same action over and over and over again, utterly convinced that this time the results will be different. So I took the second step. I clearly qualified. And then the third step is made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand it. Made a decision. Right there at the beginning of these steps, they make you make a decision. Now I make a decision based on proof. And there ain't enough proof. There's not enough proof that I'm an alcoholic. I mean, there'll never be enough proof. My little mind says, you've been dry for a long time, Sean. A little white wine with dinner wouldn't hurt. I mean, that comes up every once in a while, you know? And, I mean, maybe I've got an unnatural relationship with alcohol, but alcoholic, you know, maybe, you know? And then there's not enough proof of this program work. I've seen guys 15, 20 years have gotten drunk, so maybe this thing doesn't work. There's also not enough proof that there's a God. I mean, the classic argument about that is, you know, if there's a God, why do so many bad things happen, you know? So I wonder if there is, you know? So without enough proof that I'm an alcoholic, that this program works, and that it was a God, I had to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to him. And what I did was a pragmatic approach. I looked around the rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous and the ones whose lives seemed to function the best, the ones who seemed to be living some kind of easy life, who seemed to be able to sustain relationships and hold jobs and seemed to be able to live easily with sobriety, believed that they were alcoholic, that this program worked, and there was a God. And I said in my arrogance, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. And so I just made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand him. And I made a mistake about it. As you understand him, I thought I had to understand God in order to turn it over. And what that phrase means is no matter how diminished your understanding is, turn it over. No matter how little you understand, turn it over. And so I started doing that. See, I was an ex-Catholic. I thought I had to whip up a new dogma and some new ceremonies and print up some new holy cards, you know, But what happened was that I had my first spiritual awakening when I was about 4 months sober. I tried as much as I could to sleep through my first year of sobriety. I don't know about you, but an entire day of reality was more than I could handle. And I took a lot of naps, you know. You know. There's nothing more chilling than waking up from a nap and finding your Al-Anon who has just come home from her job looking down at you. Not a pretty sight. Anyway, I was about 4 months sober, and I went home to take a nap, and I couldn't take my nap. I was furious, and I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, I don't believe in you, and I think you're a jerk. And then it occurred to me, if I didn't believe, who was I yelling at? And then being a good ex-Catholic, I waited for 3 weeks to see if I was going to get punished for calling him a jerk. And I didn't. As a matter of fact, things got better. And out of it came a concept of God that I understand, that has made it easy for me, and maybe it'll help you. What I've come to find out is that God doesn't care whether I'm drunk or sober, and God doesn't care whether I'm good or bad. God just cares. God always has. God always will. There has been an endless resource of love and trust and hope for me all my life, and all I've got to do is tap into it, and I'll be okay. My sponsor told me that God doesn't love me because I'm good, but because God's good. And a baby of mine taught me that God doesn't have my character defects. Whew. I'd be in trouble if God had my character defects. The fourth step is the definition of the problem, and I'm the problem. And so I had to define myself. I was 3 weeks sober when my sponsor turned on me, and he said, you have 3 weeks to do your fourth step. I didn't know you couldn't do it at 3 weeks sober, so I did it. And when I was 6 weeks sober, I shared my fifth step with him, and that's the illumination step. We spread out my life on the table, and he pointed out some patterns, and he shared from his experience, and I learned to trust a little. I learned to trust him a little. And then the sixth step is the commitment step, the commitment to change. And I did it the way we all did it. I had a list of my character defects, and I gave it to God like a grocery list and said, take care of this. And then they slipped the seventh step in there, humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. And I found out some interesting stuff about the sixth and seventh step, is that in order to get rid of my defects of character, I have to be willing to give up the benefits of my defects of character. If something has 20 seconds of ecstasy and 3 weeks of pain in it, it looks like a good deal to me, you know? And I've had to be willing to give up 20 seconds of ecstasy, you know? And I also had to act like the defects of character were removed before I felt like they were removed. I had to stop stealing before I felt like stopping stealing, you know? I had to act like God had removed them. And that was interesting for me, and it has helped. And it's an ongoing step. They keep popping up in different forms, unfortunately. It's interesting. You know, the fourth step, I just want to regress a little. You know, I think every newcomer in their first meeting hears the fourth step read. I don't remember any of the other steps being read, but the fourth step of a fearless and thorough moral inventory. I heard that the first day I was sober, and I went, oh, you know. And see, what I thought I was afraid of was revealing the secrets. And I have found out that that's not what I was afraid of, and I don't think it's what any newcomer is afraid of. What I was afraid of was I knew that if I ever took up a pencil and a pad and I started writing a fourth step, that the change would start and I wouldn't have any control over it. You know? And I knew that if that change started and I had no control over it, it would keep going and going and going, and I would be smack up against my worst fear. And my worst fear, and I believe the worst fear of every alcoholic, is the fear of freedom. I have always been afraid of freedom. I have always been afraid of actually living my life with nobody to blame. I've always been afraid of living a life that I am responsible for. Because that's the other end of the fear of freedom, is the responsibility. Eve talked about that last night. And that was true of me. So the sixth and seventh step made me aware of that, oddly enough. And then the eighth step, of course, is the assessment of the damage. That's the assessment step. And the damage was to the people around, you know. And they were the people in my life. And just being sober at first was amends enough to my parents and my wife and my brother and sister-in-law and my niece and nephews and the people around. The fact that I was sober was amends enough, and then it wasn't amends enough, you know? Because Alcoholics Anonymous is not my family. I have a real family out there that I have to live with. Nobody's interested in adopting them. I mean, they're mine. I'm stuck with them. Alcoholics Anonymous is my tribe. And I come here. It is a tribe that's glued together with tolerance. You know, if I can learn to tolerate you, I can learn to tolerate me. If I can learn to love you, I can learn to love me. And so I come here to learn what I need to know out there. And I've come here to learn how to be a son. And I've come here to learn how to be a husband. And I've come here to learn how to be a brother and an uncle and a nephew, all those functions. When I was about 6 months sober, my favorite aunt died. She was the closest to my mother, and she lived in Canada. And we had no money. And I went to my sponsor and I said, my aunt is dead, and he said, how much money do you have in the savings account? And I said, $250. And he said, how much is the plane ticket? And I said, $250. He said, you take that money and you go. And I said, why? And he said, because your mother has lost her closest sister, and that's a dreadful loss. And you have to be there, because that's what sons do. And so I took the $250 and I went. And I was there for my mother. The first time ever, you know? My idea of being a family member was you ignore them all year and buy them something expensive at Christmas. And you've slowly taught me how to be those functions. And things have changed in our family. Through the process of doing the eighth and ninth step, I was able to reconcile with my father. I was able to set up a relationship with him, you know? He was not the father that I wanted, but I wasn't the son that he wanted. And we worked out something that was just fine for us. We worked out an easy way with us, because he kind of understood what I was doing. He had been briefly sober for a while. The tenth step is the maintenance step. Oh, the ninth step. Oh, the ninth step. The repair step, where you go and actually make the amends. You know, it's kind of fun when I was first sober, you know, because I'm hooked on my own adrenaline, and it was a bit of adrenaline rush, you know, because you didn't know how people were going to react when you went and made amends, you know. Most of the people that I made amends to were so drunk when we did whatever we did, they didn't remember it. But it was exciting, you know, and at first it's exciting. You know, I'm sorry I threw up on your Christmas tree, but I have this disease, you know. The ninth step is a bore when you're 5 or 6 years sober and you're still screwing up, you know, and you got no more excuse. But I continue to do the eighth and ninth step because I continue to do all that sort of stuff. The tenth step is the maintenance step, and I do that on a daily basis. See, I've always known what was right and wrong. I had always hoped as a drunk, if I did enough alcohol and enough drugs, it would make me amoral. You know, it would sweep away my morals and I could be free. And it never did that. It just desensitized me enough to be immoral. And then the next day it crashed in, you know. It always did that for me. Never did. I believe if you scratch the surface of any drunk, you'll find a prude. Certainly true of me. I am always in imminent danger of being hauled off to the pursed lips ward. You know? I sit around in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting saying, not much of a spiritual program. And the 11th step is the exploration step. You see, I believe that I am not a recovered alcoholic. I don't believe there's such a thing as a recovered alcoholic. I have recovered from a seemingly helpless state of mind and body, as the big book talks about. But I am certainly not recovered, and I don't know. I can't play around with that word. What I have is a daily reprieve that is contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I was told when I first got sober that I was going to have to search for God on a daily basis, that I would probably never find him, but that I would have to search, and I have done that. And then the 11th step is a further exploration of that, because see, in the first 9 or 10 steps, what I did was I contracted God to my understanding, you know? And in the 11th step, I started to have to expand my understanding to meet God. I had to grow as a spiritual person. There is no spiritual side to this program. This is a spiritual program. There's no way around that. I mean, there's no side to it. That's it. What we got is a daily reprieve contingent upon my spiritual condition. And I know I'm in trouble when I, you know, when I back off of my meditation or back off of my prayers. I start taking a slow, high, arcing emotional dive, you know, like going off the cliffs at Acapulco. I know it. I can feel it now, you know. And I was a child of the 60s. I knew about meditation, you know. You get stoned, you light the incense, and you meditate, you know. And what I've come to find out is a very simplified way of doing that. And I've been using meditation the wrong way. I thought if I got quiet enough that God would give me an overview of how things were going to work out. I was using meditation for fortune telling was what I was doing. And what meditation is designed to do is to get me quiet enough so that I will recognize the tools that I need this instant so I won't keep falling over them like I've done my entire life. And then the 12th step is the responsibility step. And I believe that that sobriety is the greatest gift that has ever been given to me, and I also believe it is the greatest responsibility that has ever been given to me. If I'm going to be sober today, I'm going to be the best possible sober I can be. You know, and some days you can point to me with justifiable pride as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm a shining example that this program works. You can look to me and say, there is a sober alcoholic. And some days, I don't drink. And then there are those other days when I just like to check back into the hospital and finish the moccasins, you know? A little rest. And I was told it was harder to fall out of than off of, that I was not to be on Alcoholics Anonymous, I was to be in it. I was to be active, I was not to remain anonymous within Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first night I was sober, I picked up ashtrays and I folded up chairs, and I've been doing that ever since. And God is wonderful. God is wonderful about humility, you know. I was explaining to a baby of mine one time, I said, you know, I'm really honored. You know, I've been asked to be a main speaker at a big meeting in San Diego. And then I started to laugh. He said, what are you laughing at? And I said, I'm telling you this while I'm mopping the floor of this meeting house. And so I've attempted to work the 12 steps to the best of my ability, and my life has gotten better, and it's gotten worse, and it's gotten wilder, and it's gotten funnier, and it's the most exciting thing I've ever done in my life. I love being sober. I love being sober. It is the best. It is the best. It's painful, and it's fun, and it's everything. You know? This program is not designed to kill pain, man. It's not like taking a giant Darvon, you know? What this program is designed is to bear pain, is to live through pain, is to find out and to grow from pain. And that doesn't always happen. I mean, you know, I don't always have to grow from pain either. One of the wonderful things that's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous is I've been able to give up personal experience as my only teacher. Yeah. I'm now willing to let you do it and I'll learn, you know? And the first year of sobriety, I was clinically nuts. I mean, 6 months sober, I was crazier than I'd ever been in my entire life. Absolutely bananas. I had the entire program down pat. I had it memorized. I had it from the neck up. I was Mr. AA. From the neck down, I was going nuts. When I wasn't napping, I was driving up and down the Hollywood freeway in a three-piece suit in my Mercedes, screaming at the top of my lungs. Because it was the only thing I could do to kill the pain. I was going to meetings. I was talking to my sponsor. I was working the steps. But I was nuts. When I was 9 months sober, I went on my first 12-step call, and it was explained to me that there was a difference between carrying the message and spreading the disease. And so I did the thing that I have always done at 12-step calls. When I go, I take somebody else with me, and they lay the program on the poor slob, and I make the beds and wash the dishes and clean up the apartment. I do that to this day. When I was 11 months sober, I got real scared because I'd been sober for 11 months, and things were getting better in our house. You know, she was going to Al-Anon, and she was releasing me, which felt like rejection. And there's all kinds of stuff going on in our house. But I knew that I was somehow committed to this thing. See, I'm a 50-yard dash man, and I'd been doing this for 11 months, and things were getting better, and I thought, oh, my God. I started to grasp that idea of being sober the rest of my life one day at a time, you know. They didn't tell you that when you first get sober, you know. They lie to you in this fellowship. They call it moral be revealed. And then I was 12 months sober. I was 1 year sober, and I was standing in a meeting with my little sponsor. My little sponsor cries at supermarket openings and card tricks. I mean, and he was standing there, this little guy, with tears coming down, and with the worst looking cake I've ever seen. It was this little chocolate cake with turquoise frosting on it. It had a pink candle on it, and he was standing there, everybody was singing happy birthday badly, you know. And I couldn't figure out why it felt like the most important day of my life. And the reason it was, I'd been around the block. I'd gotten drunk with Judy Garland in penthouses. You know, there was a Noel Coward remark about me that rippled through the Broadway theater world one season. You know, Katharine Hepburn gave us our wedding reception. I mean, I'd been around the block, man, you know. And there I was standing there with that awful little cake and my sponsor with a suit. And I couldn't figure out why it felt like the most important day of my life. And the reason it was that it was the most important day of my life. I had absolutely fulfilled the requirements for that cake. And I had a sense of pride that I'd never had before in my life. When I was in my second year, you started asking me to do the things. You made me treasurer and literature person and cookie lady and hospitality committee and secretary. And I knew nobody was going to ask me to be a sponsor. I knew it. Nobody wanted what I had. And when I was in my third year, a little kid asked me to be a sponsor. His name is Stefan, and I loved him. And I was a terrific sponsor. I did everything right and everything wrong. I read all the books. I bailed him out. I put him into 12-step houses, I did everything. And he got sober, and then he got drunk, and then he got sober, and then he got drunk, and then he got sober, and then he got drunk, and then he got sober, and then he got drunk, and he killed himself. And they called me and said, Stefan's dead, and I said, oh. Sometimes that memory's a little sharp. And a week later, I pulled off the Hollywood freeway because I couldn't drive my car anymore. And that was the terrible damage that alcoholism has done to me, is that awful gap between the event and the emotion, you know. And one of the wonderful gifts that you've given me is that The gap between the event and the emotion is closing. It's getting closer and closer. Thank God. I have since sponsored a lot of other guys. When I was four years sober, I was just satisfied with my progress, and so I started to think in terms of adding 12-step programs. I thought maybe I could go to Al-Anon and learn release. I figured if I had four or five 12-step programs that the change would happen four or five times faster, 12 steps was not enough for me. I thought maybe a 96-step program would do it, You see it all through the fellowship. People get to the 6th and 7th step, and bam, they refuse to change, so they start again at step one in another fellowship and go bam at that 6th step, and then they go to another one and go 6, you see that all over the place. And I also had noticed that my sponsor was human, and I was distressed at that. And he also was no longer enchanted with my character defects, I'd call him up and say, I'm going through this, and he said, are you still doing that? Why don't you work the steps? I want to find a new sponsor who would find me fascinating, he had gotten bored to death with me, and the fourth year was real tough on me. It was real tough on me. When I was 5 years sober, I decided to explore the fence lines of my sobriety. I wanted to find out just how much rope I had before I would hang myself. I wanted to find out where the edges were, and so I started exploring a whole lot of old ideas. And when I was 5.5 years sober, I blew up my life again, and I was arrested. And I had blown up my marriage, and I went home, and I told my wife what had happened. And Al-Anon had worked its miracle. I told her what had happened, and she put her hand in my face, and she said, oh, Sean, I'm so sorry you have to hurt yourself so much. And then we talked a little later, and she said, I don't understand your needs, Sean, but I do understand mine. And if you want to be married to me, I need two things from you. I need fidelity, and I need supportiveness. And you can do and give anything else you want, but those things I need. And if you can fulfill those conditions, I would be proud to remain your wife because I love you. And if you can't fulfill those conditions, I understand, and we'll have to part, and I love you. And about a week later, I took my wedding vows again with her in my sponsor's house. Her sponsor sat next to her on the couch, and I stood in front of her with my sponsor. And my 6th year, I started really exploring a spiritual life, And in my 7th year of sobriety, we decided that fear of change, we were repairing our marriage, and in my 7th year, we decided that fear of change was no longer a reason not to have children. And so we started to do that, and when I was 8.5 years sober, I helped give birth to my daughter. He called me and said, you'd better come home, and so I went back to Victoria to say goodbye to him, to tell him that I loved him and that I'd always loved him, and that I knew he loved me and that he'd always love me. And it wasn't necessary for me to tell him that I didn't approve of the way he loved me, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, you had taught me that I have no right to hand out mimeographed sheets with instructions on how to love me, that I have to accept what I get, and that my father had loved me to the best of his ability. The fact that it wasn't up to my standards was none of my goddamn business. And I went home to tell him that, and to tell him that I was okay, that my wife was all right, the child she was carrying was fine, and that if he didn't need to stay, he didn't have to. I released him from his responsibility to be my father because I no longer need a father. I don't need parents. I need to be one. And I hadn't needed parents for a long, long time. And so I came home from saying goodbye to him. My wife was 9 months pregnant. She had quit work on a Saturday. And on Tuesday, I went to work, and my company went bankrupt. And I said, okay, God, I'm real interested in how you're going to work this out. And a couple of weeks after that, my daughter was born, and I got another job, and things got better. And I'd been through a whole lot of a clump of emotions there, and my sponsor said, be very, very careful. You've been through some big stuff, and something small might come along and throw you, so be very, very careful. And I said, yeah, I understand that. And a couple of weeks later, we had a 14-year-old dog that needed to be put to sleep. And I took him to the vet, and I put him to sleep, and I walked out to the parking lot, and I put my hand on the door of the car, and I was 8.5 years sober, and I was active in this fellowship and sponsoring people and working the steps, and I put my hand on that doorknob, and I wanted a drink. I stood in that parking lot and I said, God damn it, I have put up with all this stuff, I have felt all the emotions, I have worked through it, and I want a break. And thank God for this fellowship, and thank God for what you've taught me. Because I sat in my car and I prayed for the first time in a long, long time, really, really hard. And I'll tell you something, if you feel like that at 9 o'clock in the morning and you don't have a God, you'll be drunk at noon. And I pulled the car out on the freeway. I was going to Palm Springs, and I screamed all the way to Palm Springs. what I'd done when I was 4 months sober. And things are interesting now. Things are exciting, and there's some transitions that are going on now. My daughter is 2.5 years old. She's a delight. And I've just had my salary cut in half at my job. It's up and it's down. And we're selling our house and moving, and I don't know what's going on, and it's all very wild. But I live a kind of dream now. I live a kind of dream that I never thought possible. When I was at the end of March of this year, I was asked to speak in Hawaii. And so I went over there with my wife and my daughter. And it was her second birthday, and I was standing on a deserted beach. It was miles and miles of white sand with aquamarine water. My little naked 2-year-old was running in and out of the water and squealing and screaming like little 2-year-olds do. And she has red hair, and it was the color of the sunset that night. And I stood there, and I understood that I was standing in the middle of a dream that I never conceived of, you know? And even if I could have conceived of a scene like that when I was first sober, I wouldn't have dared dream it, because it would have been pushing God's goodwill just too far. And in the process of being sober and doing what you've asked me to do, and never saying no to an AA request and showing up when it was inconvenient, you have laid gifts in my lap that I never dreamed of. And they told me to search for God on a daily basis, that I would probably never find him, but I've heard the voice of God. And if you're new and if you're having trouble with that concept, you're having trouble with God, listen here. Listen. Listen in these rooms. Listen to the laughter. Because in that laughter, you will hear the voice of God. And what God is saying is, I forgive you, why don't you forgive yourself? And so I'm working on that on a daily basis. And in the meantime, you've given me things that I never expected and never wanted. You've given me dignity. You've given me usefulness. You've given me the ability to love you first without having to you to love me. And I came here, and you knew nothing about me, and you loved me anyway. And now you know everything about me, and you love me anyway. You've given me the hardest gift to accept, and that's unearned love. But you have reversed a decision I made when I was a child. When I was a child, I decided I wasn't perfect, so I wasn't worth anything. And in the process of staying with you and being reassured by you and being loved with you, you have taught me that indeed I'm not perfect. But by God, I am not worthless. And that is a grand and a glorious gift, and I'll be forever grateful to you. God bless you.